what you like about it, what you don't like about it. Richard, why don't you go first?
And mine's quite simple. I think Black Lives Matter is doing more harm than good in American society today, particularly in terms of race relations. I think their basic concepts are fundamentally wrong. There are two big ones, I think. Let me get to the secondary one. The secondary one is that black people in America are horribly oppressed and mistreated in America. Their major issue, at least the one that seemed to have got them started, was opposition to police shootings of black males. And I think they've been fundamentally wrong about that one, too, that issue, too, because of the 40 or so police shootings that have made a lot of national attention. I think there haven't been any more than even 4 indictments against police officers for the shootings. And I don't think there's been, well, I guess there was 1 conviction, but I'm not sure it was for the shooting. That one, North Carolina, wherever it was, where the guy was running away and he shot him in the back. But I think a bigger issue, a more important issue for the black community, is black-on-black crime. Any black male today is more in more danger from black-on-black crime, I think, than he is from being shot by the police, unless he's dealing drugs. Then maybe his risk of being shot by the police becomes greater. But in a quick overview, that's my opposition to Black Lives Matter. I think they're fundamentally wrong, and I think it's time for black moderates, mainstream black people, to speak up, because the mainstream media and much of white America, I think, are coming to believe that they are the legitimate voice of the black community today.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Lewis, what do you think? What's your thesis statement? And then I'll give you guys a chance to kind of just go back and forth here.
Well, obviously, Richard Tolbert and I, though we've been long-time friends, disagree on this issue. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement brings extreme and needed attention to the issue of police brutality, which has always been at play when it comes to African Americans. African Americans are treated differently by the police. There is a history of violence and a history of racial profiling that the police inflict on African Americans and, of course, Latino men in particular, but women as well. And the violence has been just an ongoing problem. I mean, you can take this on back to the time after the Civil War, where police brutality was used to create a new form of enslavement for African American men and women. And as we move into the 21st century, deeper and deeper, this is a problem that should have gone away. This is a problem that was supposed to have been solved by the civil rights movement, but it continues. And with each recurring instance of African Americans being killed, it underscores the problem. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement has done, I think, a really poor job of publicizing what it stands for, what it's about, its structure, which is very different from what the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. did in the civil rights movement. And we have this nebulous sense of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think that what they're trying to do is to say that this is something that is embraced by African Americans everywhere. And it is, almost everywhere. But what they're also showing is that it is getting traction. It is getting attention. It's bringing needed media attention to the fact that so many unarmed African-American men are being killed. Now, is their death due to instances that could have been prevented? I'm sure in many cases that's true. But at the same time, there's a different treatment for men who are white fleeing the police versus men who are black, or men who are white confronting the police versus men who are black. The traffic stops, the studies by the Attorney General's office in Missouri, and then the studies that have been done in Kansas point out that this is an ongoing issue.
All right. Hey, I think that's a good start for us tonight. And so, Richard, what would you say to what Lewis just said, or vice versa?
We started out talking about the police issue. Let me say this. I'm a veteran of the civil rights movement. I marched with Martin Luther King Jr. not once but twice. And the second time it was the march leading up to Selma. It was dangerous to be down there. But we won the civil rights movement. The abuses of the past no longer exist in the main. And I think those examples that do exist are isolated and are sort of collateral damage from the war on drugs. And therefore, I think the average black person that's leading a normal law-abiding life doesn't have much problem with the police. Profiling is a funny concept. If, you know, you're constantly looking for black perpetrators or whatever, then of course you're going to stop black people because, you know, that's what you're looking for. If a little old lady, a little grandmother robs a bank, you don't go looking for big burly white guys. You go looking and checking out little old ladies. But I think what's happening is that people are dwelling upon the problems that black people encountered in the past. And some people even go so far as to argue that things are as bad today as ever. And as one who, I'm 72 now, I came of age right when things, the past was being overcome by the civil rights movement. It's just, it's not, well, we have several generations that have grown up the new not Pharaoh. And if you'd lived back in the bad old days when there was blatant open discrimination and segregation, you would understand that things have changed. We've won many of our struggles. It's not all over yet. We still have to play catch up as a people, as black people, to the rest of America, and other groups are moving ahead of us. But things have improved, and so to constantly harp upon the ills of the past does harm to improving race relations. I think the shootings of those Congress people that just happened these past few days is partially to blame for the hostile, uncivil atmosphere that's being created by the rhetoric of the Black Lives Matter people. And I think we need to not dwell so much in the past, but we need to focus on what's happening today.
Richard, I'm surprised that you blame the Black Lives Matter movement for the shootings that occurred in Alexandria, Virginia at the baseball diamond. The rhetoric, the poisonous rhetoric that's going on today is far larger than the black community. The Black Lives Matter movement certainly gives voice to a continuing problem that exists in America, that African Americans face, that people who are white don't. This is something that I used to write about when I was a journalist for The Star, is the police brutality. It was an ongoing concern. I want to also call your attention to the fact that if Trump were not elected, then things would be different. But Trump was elected. Trump is someone who underscores the hostility that exists between people and races, the differences underscored among men and women, of people of different ages. Trump, I think, is the mouthpiece for a lot of this wranglement that folks are engaged in, where my side is better than your side and we can't sit down and have a civil discussion. Oh, and here's my gun. And don't you dare say anything else because I'll shoot you. Now, I don't own weapons. I've never owned weapons. I think that violence is a form of communication that is the ultimate, where you're trying to say that I'm right over everyone else, and bam, you're dead. And I just don't think that that's the way to solve conflicts. Now, going back to the civil rights movement, yes, a lot of gains occurred. We were allowed to because of the Supreme Court decisions and leaders like Thurgood Marshall, to end legal segregation. Legal, I say, because the continuation of segregation occurred, but it just was manifest in different forms. We have a country that's more divided now than it's ever been, and it's divided not only along lines of race, but lines of class. So that African Americans are isolated by and large in enclaves all over the country that are poor and black. Schools, same way. But it's the same kind of inferior education that we had when segregation was the law of the land, and African Americans got the worst facilities, the worst textbooks, the worst educators. It's not changed. It's reverted back. Racism, Richard, is very much like a bacteria that can kill you. We develop different antibiotics to combat the bacteria, and for a while it gets put down, and we celebrate the fact that we've put it down, but then the bacteria mutates and changes at a rate that really outstrips the ability of the antibiotic to keep up. And so we have to develop newer and newer and newer antibiotics to combat these deadly bacteria. Racism is the same way. It is a deadly bacteria that is an infestation in American society. And we're seeing it come out more and more since Trump's been elected. I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center has done studies both when Trump was campaigning for president and afterward. They call it the Trump effect. And it has resulted in more cases of racism and violence against people of color than had been the case prior to him stepping forward in the political arena. We've got a problem in America, and we need to tackle this, and the Black Lives Matter movement is one step in the right direction.
Well, I think the Black Lives Matter movement is pouring gasoline on the fire of human racism. I really wish it were a white person disease, that only white people were infected with the disease of racism. But unfortunately, racism is a human disease. All human beings are racist in varying degrees. And I get back, though, to the shootings in the park. The guy shot the congresspeople. For years now, before Trump and after, people have been talking about the lack of civility and the lack of comedy and getting along, for example, in the Congress. Trump, no question about it, I think brought some issues back to the surface. But I think the behavior of the Black Lives Matter movement has also brought reopened old wounds, pulled scabs off of old wounds that were in the process of healing. And as I listen to you, Lewis, I guess I'm convinced that things are changing for the better. The example I can think of that I just heard on the news the past day or so was the Southern Baptist Convention passed a resolution condemning racism. Now, we got to remember who the Southern Baptists are. This is the group that split off in defense of slavery, okay? And for them to pass a resolution at their national convention saying racism is a bad thing, I think is to be celebrated, not to be condemned or put down or ignored. I do not think things are getting worse for black people. I think black people in America today, opposed to the past, but today, are the richest, fattest, happiest black people on the face of the earth. And we have some things that we've got to fix, like black-on-black crime, like poor performance in the schools, the bad attitudes of some of our young people. But that's our burden to fix it. It's in black-on-black crime. I hope I mention that again. But I don't think we need to worry that much about white racism. My observation is that white people have recognized their racism and are doing most white people, I think, are doing their best to get over their racism. Unfortunately, I feel most black people I encounter these days don't even acknowledge their own racism and aren't trying at all to get over theirs.
Well, I wanted to add a point. Lewis, you have something real quick? Go ahead.
Racism, to me, is a human problem. And it's not just something that one race or the other is subjected to. It is a human problem. I'm reading this book called Our Black Year by Maggie Johnson, and she is based in Chicago, and she decided to, for a year, she and her husband, to do nothing but buy black products for their home, for their kids, etc. And it's a great book. But what she found was that there's this old saying that the white man's ice is colder. and the belief is that products made by blacks aren't any good. It's what I grew up with hearing when I worked at my dad's chemical company. And that white products, maybe the same product, just a different label, are so much better, treated as so much better. And what she found in doing her study in trying to find black stores and promote black businesses was that African Americans gave lip service to wanting to support black businesses, but then didn't. And it caused at least one grocery store to go out of business, which was a crime. And it was the whole notion that people won't support their own. But she also found that there was a lot of racism attached, with white people saying you're being racist because you're only buying from black producers of goods and services, and that wasn't the case at all.
I wanted to add a couple things. One is, just this is a good point to talk about Lewis's book, because he has written a book, and it's recently been published, called Our Fathers. Just talk a little bit about that, because you're on the right track here, I think, which is, you know, we need to get economics. Black people need the opportunity to, you know, compete the same as white folks, and I don't think it's a level playing field right now. I think that it's still tilted against African Americans. But tell us a little bit about the book.
Sure. Our Fathers, Making Black Men is a book that I started researching in December of 2008, and it focuses on one city block in St. Louis where African-American businessmen would take kids off the street, give them jobs, teach them to have a strong work ethic, teach them the value of education, and then help them into colleges and careers. I know about this block because I grew up on that block. Dad's Chemical Company was the first black business on that block in 1947, at a time when racial covenants prevented blacks from buying property. But he and his family were able to take this large animal hospital, which was built in 1880, and buy it with cash, which circumvented the banking institutions and so many other places that wouldn't provide loans for blacks to buy in restricted areas, and then do the hard work of retrofitting this large animal hospital, which had gone out of business essentially because cars and trucks were in play rather than horses and buggies and cows, and were way outside of the city instead of right near. So they were able to take this business, retrofit it into a working chemical company that had laboratories that did microanalytical research, and then also produce their own products, goods and services for the black community. I was involved in the manufacture of those products, shipping, receiving, sales, everything that was doable, we did it. Dad also insisted that we do our own maintenance. So we had to do the plumbing, the electrical work, the masonry, you name it, we did it. And that was part of growing up. But it was also an understandable way for kids to be pulled off the street and given jobs. Now, on that same block, there was a cleaner's, a dry cleaner's, a tailor's, a shoeshine place, a grocery store. And they all did the same thing. It was just an organic way of community activism.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a great thing for Kansas City? Think what it would be like. I want to mention right now it's 7:20, and so for about a half hour here, we're going to open up the phone lines. You can call right now at 816-931-5534. We'd love to hear your comments or questions, if you would, you know, keep them fairly concise, and let our guests respond to them. Again, it's 816 931-5534. You're listening to the Thursday Night Special with Keith Washburn. I've got Louis Duguid and Richard Tolbert along with me for the ride tonight. And I wanted to ask Richard, so just an observation, which is that we had this situation in Tulsa, which you and I have discussed just briefly before, which a white police officer just shot a guy. That's the best way I know to tell it. The guy had his hands up, and I don't know what reason she shot him. She may have feared for her life, but I don't see how. And let's contrast that with the white guy in Alexandria, Virginia. And what happened there? He starts opening fire on these baseball players, these people that are practicing baseball that were Republicans. And what's the first thing the cop does? The lady says, as loud as she can, "Drop your gun." So I want to know, for Miss Betty Shelby down in Tulsa, why couldn't you have de-escalated that situation without taking a man's life? Why couldn't you have said, "Sir, either get on the ground or I'm going to shoot you. Get on the ground right now." She never said anything like that.
Well, Keith, my understanding of the facts are quite different. Remember, that case went to trial, and that officer was exonerated.
I know.
Now, the point is, there was more to the story than when he walked away with his hands in the air and reached toward his truck. My understanding is at the beginning of that story is they told him to get on the ground and stop, and he ignored the officer's instructions and walked away. When you do that, you're liable to get shot. But I think, here again, I have more faith in the courts, I guess, than a lot of people do. And when an officer is charged and there's a trial and evidence and details are presented, I don't think there have been more than one or two of the 40 or 50 cases that have made national attention where the officer has been convicted. You know, I believe that we have to give, at least let me speak for myself, I believe that because policing is dangerous work, when trouble happens, we can run away, they have to run to it, as happened in the case of the baseball thing this past week. We have to give the officer, at least I'm willing to give the officer, the benefit of the doubt. And I think you mentioned, what's the difference? Well, I think there was no difference. The guy that shot at the congresspeople got killed. The officers killed him. And I think that's what they should have done. I don't think there's such a thing as shooting the wound. If you're going to shoot somebody, you shoot to stop them. And therefore, you got to sort of shoot in the middle of the chest, the big part, you shoot to stop them. And they stopped that guy from killing more people. And I think that was good police work, and that's the way it has to be. So I think we need to see, one of the ways I think the atmosphere has been poisoned is we work from the assumption, and is the language that the Black Lives people use in some of their literature, is that white cops today murder people. There's been no officer of the 40 or 50 cases convicted of murder, to my understanding. And to not give the police the benefit of the doubt when we don't have the facts, and to assume in the beginning that they're vicious, racist murderers, poisons our atmosphere, sets back race relations, and does us all no good. But I think you mentioned the case. But I'd just like to comment on Lewis's case about his father's experience in St. Louis. As I understand Lewis's father's case, this was back in the 40s, and he started back in the bad old days when things were really rough for black people and opportunities were limited in 100 different ways, and he persevered and succeeded. Today, there's, to my observation, nobody or no institution, nothing, is standing in the way of any black person that wants to create a business for himself. Now, you got to have some money, but there are plenty of black people around with money. We just are not, as a people, in the habit of investing our money in each other. That will come in time. But there's nothing standing in the way of black people cleaning up the problems of the black community except us. We're standing in our own way. And I think as soon as we stop blaming the white man for all of our troubles and get to work cleaning up our own, let me clean up my language, cleaning up our own messes, the better off we're going to be.
Okay. I think we have a caller, I hope. Is our caller there? You're on the air. Your name and area town you're calling in from? Are you there? All right, we lost that caller. Hopefully they'll call back. Louis, what do you think?
Well, in the case of the Alexandria, Virginia shooting, the suspect there had a clear opportunity to drop his weapon. He was given that chance, and that hasn't been afforded to African Americans, whether it was in Dallas or Minnesota or Louisiana or North Carolina or outside of St. Louis, it wasn't afforded to black people there. It was just bang, bang, I'm sorry, you're done. Tamir Rice, 12 seconds. The cop got out of the car just within seconds and shot the 12-year-old. Not a warning, nothing. So there's just a difference. And there's a wonderful book called The Color of Crime by Catherine Russell that explains that for the police officers and the courts and the lawyers that are involved, African Americans come in with a criminal aura around them to begin with, so that any engagement that law enforcement has with them from the start is always with African Americans being viewed as suspects, as individuals who did something wrong. And that's really the wrong way to approach people who are black. Same thing happens to Latinos, but it's different for people who are white. There's always the assumption that it's not that bad, and let's give the guy a chance.
Well, you know, that's a good point. That's a negative aura that surrounds black people. I think the Black Lives Matter movement has contributed to that, this notion that black people are horribly oppressed and mistreated and that the police are murdering black people. I keep looking at the court cases where, you know, the system has put officers on trial. The Baltimore case is a good one. Ferguson is the best. I hope we can discuss Ferguson sometime, because I think the facts are better known in the Ferguson case than in any of the others. But the case in Baltimore, the judge was black. I don't know what percentage of the jury was black, but the judge said the officers were not in the wrong. Now, people were out marching and whooping it up and demonstrating and everything, you know, talking about, you know, racist police and all that. And the police, some, I think most of them were black. I think it was one white guy that was on trial. The rest of them, two or three others, were black. I think Black Lives Matter has poured fuel on the fire. People have memories of what it was like in the past, okay? And I know what it was like in the past. But we've overcome that. We've gotten beyond that, and it's time for us to look within, deal with black-on-black crime, which is 100 times more dangerous than what any cop is going to do to a law-abiding person. And we need to concentrate on cleaning up our own community.
All right,
I give police the benefit of the doubt.
All right, let's take a caller. I hope we have somebody on the line now. Caller, your name and area town you're calling in from. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Melvin from Midtown. How you doing, Keith?
Hey, Melvin. Thanks for calling in tonight, man.
Sure. I like your topic. Your topic is hot. But my comment is, especially with the Black Lives Matter, and I understand the connotations in it in terms of Black Lives Matter. And Black Lives does matter, as well as all lives matter. However, it seemed like it was open war on black lives. And that's where I think that they got this, that, you know, when they threw their hands up and said, you know, our lives matter. And it does, just as well as any life, white lives or any life. But the point that it's gotten to the point where policemen were just seemed like they were just open fire on black men, young black men, like the one that was in that park, and that kid that was shot, and then the guy that was running away from the police that was shot 8 times in the back. And most of these policemen, and, you know, matter of fact, I have an event coming up with several different law enforcement that's going to be there. And I believe that we need our police officers. You know, where would we be if we didn't have officers to come in within the community? But, however, it has gotten to the point where it was offhand with the rhetoric that Trump was throwing out there. You know, especially with, you know, I'm going to pay your bail and, you know, your court costs and your attorney fees. And it was like it would open up a Pandora box. You can shoot a black and then answer for it later. But it was always watered down for whatever the police did. And they did some things that was just, you know, like the guy that shot the kid that had the knife in his hand, but he was walking away from the police, shot him, I think it was 16 times. That was called overkill.
Yeah,
and so, you know, that's the part that I have a problem with, and I understand Black Lives Matter, and I understand why they said that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for calling in tonight, Melvin. So
thanks, Keith.
Yeah.
Great show.
Hey, thank you.
I'm a fan of you, Keith.
Hey, I appreciate you, man. So that was Melvin calling in. He's a programmer here at KKFI. And let's give our two guests a chance to respond.
Well, I appreciate what he brought to the table. Richard and I obviously differ. I think the Black Lives Matter movement brings needed attention to a real concern that's always been there with police brutality in the black community. Richard says it adds fuel to the fire. When that's the exact argument that the people on the right use to say, just be quiet, don't bring attention to these issues, and it'll go away. Well, it hasn't gone away in 400 years, and it's still a problem, and it's going to be a problem. Now, the other piece of it is that you'd have to go on the internet, because you haven't seen it in the Kansas City Star or any of the other newspapers, but Australia gave the Black Lives Matter movement a peace award, a global peace award, for it bringing attention to this whole issue of police brutality and violence against black people.
You know, one has to remind everybody, there may have been 15 notorious police shooting cases, but there have been thousands of black-on-black killings the past couple of years. The danger to black people is much greater from the black-on-black crime than it is from these police cases. The Ferguson case is the one case where I think the facts are well known and well understood and perhaps even well agreed upon. What happened here? A guy's walking down the street. The officer says, get out of the street. He does it. The officer starts to get out of his car, and the undisputed testimony is that Brown, the kid that got killed, walks up and shoves the door on the officer, struggles with the officer for his gun. The gun is discharged. Brown runs away. The officer runs after him and shoots him. Now, this hands-up, don't-shoot thing that Melvin, the caller, referred to has been discredited as something that's not justified by what happened that day. And who knows? There are two accounts of what Brown did when he turned around and faced the officers. The Black Lives Matter people say he was trying to surrender, hands up, don't shoot. The coroner, I think, said he was lunging for the officer. But the point is, he committed a whole string of bad acts that justified, I think, him getting shot, to put it bluntly.
Without a doubt, that is a very confusing case. Number one, the street in Ferguson where this occurred was a very quiet residential street. It wasn't West Florissant, which is busy, and the quiet street emptied into West Florissant. So the police officer, I think, was wrong to tell the young men to get out of the street to begin with. If the officer had let that go, Michael Brown would have probably been graduating from college right now. You're right. Michael Brown overreacted to the officer. And there were any number of mistakes that were made, both on the officer's part and on Michael Brown's part. The officer was exonerated from state and federal charges because of the lack of clarity. But that's the way all cases go when there isn't a clear cut, he did it, she was wrong, issue involving African Americans or police officers with using the ultimate force.
All right, let's take another caller. You're on the air. Your name and area town you're calling in from? Are you there, caller? Caller? All right, we'll try another caller over
Hello?
Here. Yes,
Hello?
Go ahead. We had a little trouble getting you connected there. What's your name and area town you're calling in from?
Yeah, this is Maurice Copeland.
Mr. Copeland, Midtown. How you doing?
Yeah, all right. I want to agree with Richard on a big fact, and I do consider it a fact. The black community's biggest problems are within our own community, and we have to take care of that. I think you're 100% right, Richard. And I also heard, I think, from Richard, that the black community, not the black community, but Black Lives Matter, that they seem to be projected as the voice of black people.
Yes, or I did say that.
I see the Black Lives Matter movement, I guess, in a kind of fog. I see them as a diverse group. I've been involved with them, and I've been looking at them, and I see it as a very diverse group, and I don't think any way possible that they're going to be projected as the voice of the black community or black people, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, Maurice, you missed what Keith said a minute ago. One of the things I've noticed is people are starting to give Black Lives Matter founders and whatnot peace awards, and they're being quoted frequently in the national media, and I guess local media too, I listen to both, as the voice of the black community. They're not an organization the way I guess we were familiar during the civil rights era. Now, things change and maybe we have to come up with a different way. But the problem is, when I was trying to prepare for this discussion and I went trying to find out exactly, now, what is the Black Lives Matter thing? They don't have meetings here in town. They say they have chapters all over the country, but they're not really organized. They're just people sort of reacting emotionally to the sins of the past, and they're doing harm by pulling scabs off of old wounds that had started to heal.
All right. We've got about four callers, so I'd ask all the callers to please be patient with us, and let's try to take them quickly. And callers, if you could, all be very concise with your comments. First of all, this caller, what area town and what's your name? You're on the air. You're on
okay,
the air.
Okay, well, I'll get off. I'm still on.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. Thanks for calling in, Maurice. We appreciate it.
He was nice and short.
And we'll go with this caller. Caller, you're on the air. Area town you're calling in from and your name.
Is that my call?
You are on the air.
Okay, yes. My name is Marie. And, I don't know where to begin with my conversation about Black Lives Matter. The main thing that comes across with me, I'm an older person, lived through the civil rights era, observed the Black Panthers and what they did in the movement, and I see the Black Lives Matter, and I do consider it a movement, as a necessary thing to occur, because we have got a problem with police violence toward sometimes people who are not really in the midst of trying to threaten, to harm a policeman or being shot. The biggest event I remember that really affected me was the 12-year-old child in Cleveland. And I don't know. I'll just say it the way I feel about it.
Yeah, if you could, please,
I just don't believe that a white child would have been shot down like that. And that's really a profound feeling, a concern. If you feel that, and I do, that is definitely a racist situation. Maybe it's subconscious. Maybe I don't know what the problem is with those types of policemen. All police are not bad. All policemen are not bad. I realize that. But you do have too many of them who are.
Well, we do appreciate you calling in. That's a very heartfelt comment. Thanks for calling in tonight, Marie. And I'm going to give our guests a quick chance to respond to that. And I also want to remind all of our listeners that you are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's the Thursday night special with Louis Duguid and Richard Tolbert. Gentlemen?
I want to go back to something that Richard pointed out. The civil rights movement was not seen as or embraced as a movement by all of the black community when it was occurring from the mid-1950s until toward the end of the 1960s.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't. That people saw Dr. King as a rabble-rouser, as a troublemaker, as someone who was coming in and bringing this dissent in communities that had already established their way of how they were going to let people get along.
Not true.
Now, he did the right thing, but he was not universally embraced. I mean, when he wrote his letter from the Birmingham jail, he said, wait almost always means never. He wasn't just speaking to white America. He was speaking, in many cases, to black America, too. Now, the other piece of it that you mentioned that I think is important is that, yes, we do have a radical problem with black-on-black crime, and African-Americans must step up to address those concerns. That's what my latest book is about, Our Fathers Making Black Men, is we have to get involved in the lives of young people early in order to fix them as children so that they can grow up to be men. As Frederick Douglass said, It is a lot harder to fix children than to repair damaged men.
Well, forgive me for my interruptions, but when you say we did not have a civil rights movement that was embraced by the black community, I think that's just flat wrong. Of course, not 100% of the people agree with anything, but the overwhelming majority of the black community supported the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement was an organized movement with several different leaders in it. Martin Luther King became the most prominent, I suppose, in the 60s. But there were other leaders, the NAACP, the Urban League, A. Philip Randolph. The problem with the Black Lives Matter thing, they're not trying to create any kind of movement. Marie, the caller, the lady caller, said she supports the movement. Well, there ought to be a movement that's about doing something. And one of the things I would say is the black community, to deal with our other problems, needs to create some organization that's about dealing with these intractable problems in the black community, such as black-on-black crime, the poor performance in schools, the persistence of poverty for some of us. But we need to remember, most black people are no longer in poverty today. The majority are out of poverty. Two-thirds, at least, are above the federal poverty line.
You need to read this book called White Rage by Dr. Anderson, and she details from the start of slavery into today how these issues of white oppression of African Americans have continued and have only increased.
I disagree, Lewis. I don't think they've increased at all. I think they're declining. There's still remnants left. Social change is always a slow process. It takes a long time to clean up old messes. But I think things are moving in the right direction. But black people need to work to fix things. We can't have people that don't understand the dynamics of our community very well trying to fix the problems we have in our community.
Let's take another caller. Callers, thank you for being patient with us. We've just got the phone lines overloaded. Caller, you're on the air. Your name and area town you're calling in from?
Yeah, this is Bingo from Waldo.
Bingo. Yeah, we got so many callers tonight. Glad to hear your voice, brother.
Well, glad you're on talking about this. I just want to see if I can get your guests to comment on a few things. This is a little bit different question than way things have been going, but I want to know how come the murder rate in Kansas City has remained static for 27 years. I mean, I'm going by KCPD statistics, historical crime statistics they published, and I don't have the exact figure here, but around 1990, it was about 117 around that area. 2006, it spiked a little bit at 127, but in the years in between, it's been pretty generally around 115, 120, around that area. So this is at the same time we're having huge historic drops in crime rates and murder rates in other large American cities such as New York, and I want to know why our officials aren't rushing off to New York to see how they did it with everything they can do to try to make this thing change. And to me, promotions like Just Say No to Bullying in the media seem like a hopelessly weak kind of a way to try to do anything about such a catastrophic kind of a thing in a community that affects everybody in the community, everybody's mental outlook, you know, not just the people who are experiencing the direct murdering or whatever it is, catchphrases and slogans and all the usual kind of media emotional manipulation and trying to get stirring people up isn't going to get anything done. And I'd like to finish with violence is a quest for identity, you know, and dialogue is the only alternative to that. And I'd like to hear your guest comments on that.
I'd like to comment.
Amen. Thanks for calling in, Bingo.
I'd like to jump in real fast. The question Bingo asked is why the murder rate has persisted for so long. And my observation is it's the war on drugs that's created an underworld of criminal activity that's generating murders. You know, when straight people, normal people, have a falling out or something, you hire a lawyer and go to court. When the underworld people have a falling out, you shoot the other person. And I think as long as we have this so-called war on drugs, and I think many people are starting to recognize it's evolved into a war on black people, we're going to have a disproportionate number of murders. We're going to have a disproportionate amount of black-on-black crime. The other thing Bingo mentioned was other cities. I'm curious about the New York City experiment under Rudy Giuliani, where they had the broken glass thing or something, where they went out and enforced every law they could, and their murder rate, as I understand it, went down. He's been much criticized for that, and people accuse him of profiling and racism and all that, and then the rate's gone back up, as I understand it. But I'm curious myself, and I'd like to have more detail about what exactly happened during that period when they had a broken glass theory, I think that was the name of a theory, about let's enforce every crime, get the small guys off the street, and that seemed to have had some effect.
All right, Lewis.
Well, Richard, you raised many issues. Let's do Rudy Giuliani first. He came in with that constitutionally invalid policy at a time when the murder rate was going down anyway. The people who were committing those kinds of crimes were aging out. And so you cannot give him or his Gestapo tactics credit for something that was going to occur naturally, and it did in many cities. The other piece is that crime is, I think, an outgrowth of people not having opportunity. When you take opportunity away, particularly in the urban core in many cities, you take away the ability for people to make ends meet, to raise their families, to pay their taxes, to live on the right side of the law. And yes, unfortunately, when all they see are people doing illegal, illicit behavior, that's what they follow. The other piece is that you cannot blame the war on drugs for all of the crime that occurs. Now, it takes up a big chunk of it, but there's a lot more at play. I mean, you have domestic disturbances. You have arguments that blow up between two individuals. The problem really is we live in a gun culture, and our gun culture is just out of control.
All right, let's take another caller before, and you can have a chance here right after this, Richard. We've got a couple callers waiting. If you would, caller, give your name and area town you're calling in from. Caller, you're on the air. All right, let's try this, caller.
Midtown area.
Okay, say it again, ma'am, please.
My name is Justice.
All right, Justice. Love the name. And from the Raytown area, is that what you said?
No, Midtown.
All right, you are on the air.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate this conversation. I've been listening and cringing, oh my God, at some of the things I've heard, especially as it pertains to black-on-black crime, so to speak. And it's interesting to me because we always use this as an excuse not to work on the other issues. No one ever talks about white-on-white crime in the way that we talk about black-on-black crime. And it is true that people commit murders in proportion to where they live. And most black people live by other black people, so they're, in fact, their victims would be black, just like white communities. But we don't talk about white-on-white crime in that way. And speaking of the Black Lives Matter movement, which it is a global movement, and in relation to Dr. King's civil rights movement, the speaker was in fact correct. Dr. King was not embraced. He was not loved. When those children skipped school that day, their parents were not pleased. Okay, it was the youth. It's always been the young people to propel the movement forward, because we get people who they get satisfied in their position where they're at. They get comfortable where they're at. And quite frankly, people are afraid. But I can tell you from experience and from listening to other people that we have a serious problem with the police in this country, and we have a serious problem with the police right here in Kansas City, Missouri. Black Lives Matter is trying to answer that. I do not think that we should hold regular citizens to the same degree as we hold a police officer. Police officers should be held to a higher degree. They've taken an oath to serve and protect. They've taken an oath to serve with integrity, and we expect that. So when we see cops choking people out, when we see cops pulling up on little black kids and shooting them within seconds of seeing them, we know we have a problem, and we need to confront it head on instead of trying to merge with other stuff like black on black crime or anything else. I could say a whole lot more, but I'm going to let other callers have an opportunity to speak. I'm cringing over here.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. Thanks for calling in, Justice. We really appreciate the comments. Thanks for calling in.
Keith, I would like to rebut something Lewis said a minute ago about lack of opportunity. And I guess you mean for employment, for jobs or whatnot. We've come out of a recession that we've been in, and everywhere you look, people are hiring now. I don't think lack of job opportunity can be used as an excuse to explain away the disproportionate number of murders that are taking place in the black community and the crime in the black community. And I think employment... Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I don't know how many black people have jobs, how many don't. I think we probably all agree that the unemployment rate is probably higher, is much higher in the black community. But people are hiring now. Schools are bending over backwards to train people for jobs. People are getting placed on jobs and then losing out because they won't get up and go to work in the morning or because they won't pass the drug tests or whatever. And I think we in the black community have to take a hard, cold-blooded look at what's going on in our community and not keep making excuses for people that don't apply themselves and help themselves get on the right track.
It's not an excuse, Richard, when you have empty storefronts that are all throughout the 3rd and the 5th district.
There aren't that many empty
And then you take it on down to the 6th district, where African Americans have migrated as blockbusting has continued south. And there is a lack of opportunity, a lack of jobs there.
Lewis, you keep mentioning blockbusting. I don't think there is any blockbusting anymore. If you've got money, regardless of what color you are, you can buy a house anywhere you want.
But you
I was
have
out
to
visiting some black friends in one of the best areas of Johnson County. I was marveling at these wonderful, nice houses they've got out there. Lee Summit, you know. Blockbusting is a thing of the past. They stopped doing that. It doesn't work anymore. And I think we have to live in the present rather than keep dwelling on the issues of the past.
All right. I do have one more caller, and I think this caller has called in like 3 times and gotten cut off. So let's try her because she's on the road. Are you there, caller?
I am.
All right. So if you would briefly, because we're running out of time, tell us your question or comment and your name and the area town you're calling in from, which I think is Indiana somewhere, right?
That's correct. And I agree with both guys make a valid point. I think that we all need to take responsibility for the situation. Black, white, we all should try and correct the problem. I do believe that if you're African American, you have a better understanding of the culture. And so you will be able to make a bigger difference if you take the responsibility to try and make the change. I think a lot of things have changed since the 60s, I'll just say, or probably forever. Things are changing, and I think it's for the better. And I think a lot of the issues, like with Ferguson and stuff, the media plays it up to make a good story, but we don't always get all the facts, and it stirs up people. So that's about what I got to say.
All right. Thanks for trying us again, and thanks for calling in tonight with those comments. So she tried to get in as our very first caller, and at that time we were having a little bit of technical. Our phone answer tonight is Dennis Nelson. It's the first time he's ever done it, and so he didn't know how to do it, and so we had to give him several shots at it. And so thanks for calling back, Kathleen. Gentlemen, let's wrap up with a couple of comments, just about 60 seconds.
I think that it's imperative that people who value the lives of African Americans to really look into the Black Lives Matter movement and try to do what they can to be engaged in the discussion of why Black lives should matter. It's as if you go to a doctor and the doctor says, you've got all of these bones, but you're just crying over the fact that you've broken your arm. Why should I pay attention to this one bone when all the others are doing very well? And we need to pay attention to where we hurt in America. And where we hurt is in making the lives of African Americans, particularly African Americans' youth, matter in education, in jobs, and in careers.
All right. Good comment, Richard.
I think we need to look elsewhere in the Black community for leadership in dealing with these problems that we do have in the Black community. If you listen to the Black Lives Matter people, why would you even bother to go to school or go to a job training program if you're constantly being told that white man and white racism is not going to let you do anything, you're not going to be able to get anywhere, you can't do this, you can't do that? That's not true anymore. It used to be true, maybe. Well, it was never absolutely true, because I point to the example of Lewis's father that built a successful business back in the bad old days. But it's not as hard as it used to be for a Black person to get ahead and to achieve. Main thing is go to school.
Well, gentlemen, it has been my pleasure and an honor to host this show. You guys were great. It's two alternative views, but you agree on many points, too. So I'd like to have both of you come back. Maybe we'll do a round two of this. Lewis Duguid with the new book, and Richard Tolbert, as always, interesting. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
And we're going to wrap it up here. Coming up next is the Thursday night special. This is the Thursday night special. And next is the Thursday night local showcase. Yours truly will be hosting that as well. And I think we've got Mark Montgomery in the house. Here's Stevie to close us out.
From all of us here at KKFI, Voice of the Community, we would like to say thank you to every single supporter throughout the 2017 Spring Fund Drive. And a special thank you to Aaron, Mig, and Terry at Californos and Westport for their continued support in sustaining our wonderful volunteers. Thank you, Californos. Alpha Women, right back. Join KKFI for a creative-filled evening with prominent writers Iris Applequist, Annette Billings, and Krista Siglin as they read poetry, discuss their work, pose questions, and talk back to audience members Friday, June 23rd, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Cherry Pit